Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. You're listening to The Voice of Kansas on Blog Talk Radio, The Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Carl G. Well, it's World War III and only 6 months to May Day. Due to the outbreak of war, we will be playing more heavy metal all winter. So I call this the thrash metal band Slayer performs Das Kapital. Keep in mind, this is an anti-capitalist abolitionist podcast. We begin the mixtape with an Illinois Nazi named Fritz, broadcasting on his ham radio in 1941 from Peoria, Illinois. And we'll hear more about this strange and bizarre tale of propaganda. Then we'll hear from Isaac Ritter about the Free Network Foundation, how to build internet from the ground up in your neighborhood. Bill Watterson has a new book out called The Mysteries. We'll listen to Renegade Cut as he talks about what Calvin and Hobbes means to Generation X. Then we'll listen with Bob Barr, the author of the book Syriana, as he talks about assassination and whether or not it has effect on history. Then we're going to hear about night raids in Afghanistan with the CIA's zero units. Then we'll finish up with Claire Mate on the capitalist order. How the hell has austerity been so successful? You'll be listening to the Slayer Rain and Blood Tour 2004. You're listening to The Voice of Kansas on Blog Talk Radio, The Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. And I'm your host, Carl G.
In the early days of 1941, while World War II raged across Europe, a mysterious radio signal was heard on the airwaves. It alarmed FCC monitors and federal agents in the United States and sent them on a frantic chase to uncover its location and seek the identity of its operator. The station wasn't being operated in a manner that seemed calculated in order to avoid being monitored, in fact, far from it. It first turned up on April 17, 1941, when it broke into an FCC net and attempted to engage the FCC stations in communications. 2 days later, the station appeared again, but this time on several other frequencies, including 3497.5, 4025, and 6990 kHz, all frequencies in active use by the Army at that time. Identifying himself only as Fritz, the operator of the mysterious station again tried to make contact with the FCC net. He announced no call sign and repeated the phrase Heil Hitler. With the United States on the brink of war with Germany and with rumors of German espionage agents and saboteurs rampant to the point where even American com operators were forbidden to make contact with overseas stations, this station was cause for serious concern. blatantly trying to contact the station of war, operated by the War Department headquarters in Washington, Fritz was also eager to talk to all other stations in the Army network. Monitors noted that Fritz seemed to have more than average knowledge of codes and ciphers, and perhaps justifiably so, since he bragged that he was a cryptographer and also a member of an advanced unit of the German Army of Occupation. At first, the military stations attempted to ignore him. However, this did little to deter him from broadcasting his various messages, which he claimed were being relayed from foreign agents. He also liked to play recordings of German military music and speeches made by Adolf Hitler. In one transmission, he announced that high-powered transmitters were being constructed in order to jam military frequencies. Another time, he sent a lengthy message in cipher, which, when deciphered by federal monitors, turned out to be in German and related to certain foreign troop movements. Fritz was also attempting to solicit military information from the stations on frequency. By April the 21st, the government had put into effect its plan of attack. Army stations were authorized to reply to Fritz and his so-called Heil Hitler radio station and engage him in lengthy conversation, while the SDC took long-range direction finding bearings on the transmitter so that mobile units could be dispatched to his location. Each time Fritz screamed Heil Hitler into his microphone, it seemed to cause the hunt to become more intense, and additional federal agents and agencies to be put on the case. Army stations did attempt to coax Fritz into revealing his location, however he was evasive. Upon continued pressing for this information, he said that he was on the Admiral Scheer, a German battleship located off the coast of Madagascar. He added that the Admiral Scheer never docked. Monitors didn't buy Fritz's story. They knew that he was within the borders of the United States and somewhere in the Midwest. Although transmissions of this nature today would probably be immediately viewed as the antics of a pirate, in the mood the nation was in at that period of time, the government regarded all such matters with deadly seriousness. By April the 21st, the government's direction-finding efforts had pinpointed the general area of Peoria, Illinois. All sorts of important people were now called into the operation to aid the FCC field staff. Some of those personally involved included United States Commissioner William H. Moore, United States District Attorney Howard L. Doyle, United States Marshals Eugene Ahearns and C.C. Curie, as well as Chief of Police Leo F. Cummins of Peoria. April the 22nd saw FCC Mobile Direction Units cruising the streets of Peoria. The following day they drove up North Sheridan Road and stopped near the home of Charles W. Johnson. The final day of the station's operation was April the 30th, when a task force of federal agents and local police broke in on Johnson while he was engaged in communications with an army station. He attempted to destroy the transmitter, but wasn't able to do so. He was arrested and held on $2,000 bond before being promptly brought before a grand jury, where he was indicted for violating Sections 301 and 308 of the Communications Act. This effectively ended the strange existence of Fritz and the Heil Hitler station. Johnson's activities weren't all that unusual for the period preceding and following the United States' entry into World War II. The FCC had spent several years monitoring and pursuing unauthorized radio stations on the theory that at least some of them were the result of German espionage activities. In 1940 alone, the FCC tracked down more than 1,000 illegal stations. During the month of June 1941, almost 20 licensed hams were apprehended by the FCC for unauthorized contacts with overseas operators. Further investigation in the Fritz case revealed that although Peoria's local ham operators were well aware of his activities, little effort was made by hams to track him down on the theory that it might have proven embarrassing should he have turned out to be either a licensed operator or someone who was seeking a ham license. As it turned out, he was neither. It also came to light that Peoria's Fritz wasn't even very original, and that he was actually copying another earlier Fritz from Massachusetts who had been successful for many years before finally getting caught. The original Fritz was caught by hams who ragtuned with him while the FCC zeroed in his location with direction finders. By the time Fritz number 2 was apprehended in April of 1941, the FCC had increased its field monitoring staff from fewer than 200 to more than 600. direction-finding units were installed in vehicles and also at fixed listening posts located at 200-mile intervals. There were also 10 long-range DF stations keeping a 24-hour vigil on the airwaves, checking out foreign broadcasts and conversations, encoded transmissions, and any activities which sounded suspicious throughout the radio spectrum. Mobile units working in conjunction with fixed stations would plot signal bearings on maps to ascertain the location of unlikely stations and other unidentified transmissions. Recordings were also made of many transmissions under investigation. Even though it has become increasingly difficult for stations to avoid detection for any extended period of time, many people seem quite willing to make the try for all sorts of reasons. Some caught by the FCC were actually enemy agents. While many others weren't enemy agents, their activities were either jeopardising national security or were in violation of pre-war restrictions, or, like Fritz No. 2, were causing deliberate interference to vital communication circuits. The fact that illegal radio activity had substantially increased simultaneously with growing war production and preparedness made such surveillance and enforcement necessary. FCC monitors were kept busy with these tasks throughout the entire period of World War II.
What's up, kids? My name is Evan Hayes. I'd like to welcome you to our show today. I got a special guest here with me. Isaac Wheeler. Yo, what's up? I'm Isaac Wheeler, and I am one of the directors of the Free Network Foundation. We're a group, national group, that hopes to use those internet calls. I'm from here in Kansas City. We're operating here in Kansas City, working with a bunch of people around the metro, building a network, other people's networks. So that is basically what we have to do that. Rather than going out to Time Warner or Google or YouTube, you become part of something that replaces those internet service providers with something that you are a part of. So that's the basic premise to computer networks for the people. And so are the networks that you're familiar with, how would a person or a people get access to the cost of the network? So if you come out of where they have employees, how do they get access to the actual network?
Depends on sort of what people are asked and how involved they want to be. Now, if somebody wants to be said, hey, come put this into me, I'm not a techie, I'm not interested, you can make that happen, you know? The ideal situation that we'd like to have happen is to propose from the community to build these skills, learn how to do these installations, learn how to build these networks, and then when somebody in their neighborhood or somebody in their community wants to get online, they call up, they say, hey, I need internet. And somebody actually from their community comes out and does. And maybe they from about 300 or 20 bucks or whatever, however, you know, depending on how much it takes. But you know, just a reasonable fee for somebody to come out and do that, and then not necessarily. So the way it works is like the co-op. The idea of a co-op doesn't make sense on your own. If you're on your own, it's not a co-op. So in order for the idea to work, what has to happen is that people have to cooperate. That's the essence of the idea.
Certainly, you have one house, one home, and you have a boss, and you start over time to get access to the
So the way it works is that right now we've got $7.50. And here's the
Doom-scrolling through my timeline on what was once called Twitter. Social media platforms have become avenues to spread misinformation during the crisis, and the worst of the worst were in full force that day. The right wing and their hapless liberal accomplices called for collective punishment against Palestine, justified by mindless, heartless propaganda as if civilians who had long suffered under apartheid were somehow responsible, impossibly, for their own deaths. Nobody learned anything from 9/11, with the exception of those who discovered how best to weaponize nationalistic zealotry. Democrats, Republicans, and their innumerable bots bickered at each other over who should be Speaker of the House, who should be the symbolic frontman of their band of murderers and thieves. The right-wing guy, or the right-wing guy, or the really right-wing guy. How do you choose among a white supremacist, a Trumpian fascist, and a Christo-fascist? The Biden administration announced, a few days prior, that it would begin expanding the border wall begun by the Trump administration, deporting thousands of immigrants who travel to the United States seeking asylum in the nation most responsible for their impoverished conditions and destabilized economy. And all these blue wave freaks had to say about it was, better than Trump, a barely defensible half-truth that is beginning to erode altogether. And then, light in the distance, a piece of actual good news, a hardly even important scrap of popular culture anesthetic. A reclusive artist, most famous for creating greatest of all time newspaper comic strip Calvin and Hobbes, had produced another significant work for the world to enjoy, an illustrated fable for adults entitled The Mysteries. At long last, after decades of waiting, Bill Watterson wrote a new book. To clarify, although Watterson himself is credited as the writer, the illustrations are a collaboration between himself and caricaturist John Cash. The day of its release, October 10th, was the first time I had heard of this new book. Once a year, for as long as search engines existed, I typed Bill Watterson to see whether or not the J.D. Salinger of comics was up to anything. When it appeared on my timeline, I rushed down to the nearest Barnes & Noble. I didn't want to order the book online and wait a day or two for it to arrive. I had waited long enough. We all had. In the years following the end of his famous comic strip, Watterson had written and drawn little else that had been made public. In 1999, he wrote a short article in the Los Angeles Times about the anniversary of the comic strip Peanuts. In 2008, he wrote the foreword to a comic strip collected works by Richard Thompson. Years later, he and four other men wrote a kind of tribute to the art of Richard Thompson. And in 2014, Watterson provided guest illustrations for three strips of Pearls Before Swine. And that's about it. Watterson almost never gives interviews, almost never makes public appearances, and he seemingly has no interest in returning to the art form that made him famous, nor endeavoring in many other public projects. Watterson thinks in his spare time, but rarely shows anyone his work. He shuns the spotlight. He doesn't live in isolation, though. He just lives what he considers to be an ordinary life. Even the release of The Mysteries was done without much fanfare. No wonder I was caught off guard. Everyone was. 2023's The Mysteries is only about 72 pages long, but that figure might give a false impression. 72 pages is either close to the maximum length of a short story or the minimum length of a novella, or novelette. However, half of the pages in The Mysteries are illustrations, and the pages with words usually only have a sentence or two. In form only, The Mysteries resembles what is sometimes called a children's book, but this is described by the creators as a fable for adults, not children. A picture book is perhaps the best descriptor, although one online retailer, the worst one, calls it a fantasy manga, which just cannot be true. The Mysteries is not a novel, but let's examine this based on that criteria for a moment. Whether a work of fiction is a novelette, novella, or novel is more commonly characterized by word count, not page count. In total, The Mysteries is approximately 370 words long. Not pages, words. The exact count depends on whether or not we consider the title and whether a hyphenated word counts as one or two words. To give you some idea of how short that is, at this point in the video that you're watching, you're about 900 words deep, more than twice the length of this smallish book. The Mysteries can be finished in a matter of minutes. Yet, this book is arguably Watterson's most significant work since the end of Calvin and Hobbes, nearly three decades ago. Calvin and Hobbes was a comic strip that ran from 1985 to 1995. For young people growing up in the 80s and 90s, this was the newspaper comic strip. Garfield made more money through merchandising and television shows. Peanuts had a longer run. But Calvin and Hobbes was the cool comic strip for kids. The collected works were hot items at book fairs. Calvin was the imaginative, rebellious child that we all wanted to be, despite his glaring flaws, and Hobbes was the best friend that we all desperately wanted. Those strips centered around Calvin seeing the world differently than the other children and his parents, imagining himself as a private detective or a space adventurer. His teacher, babysitter, and parents were his various arch-nemeses, plotting his destruction. Calvin had no friends except for his stuffed tiger, Hobbes, only an antagonistic relationship with Susie Durkin, and a passing familiarity with the other students. Some children read Calvin and Hobbes because it was funny. Other children read Calvin and Hobbes because it was tragic. Relatable. In this strip from October 30th, 1987, Calvin imagines himself as Stupendous Man, hearing a cry for help in a nameless city. As the superhero, he leans over the edge of the building, remarking on both the height and danger. The next panel is the punchline. Calvin is actually atop a slide, clearly afraid to go down, but unwilling to acknowledge that to Susie or to himself. In this strip from November 3rd, 1988, Calvin wears his Stupendous Man costume to dinner. He claims that being Stupendous Man while eating is necessary, offering only that the cape hero has a stomach of steel. In this strip, Calvin, as Stupendous Man, performs the time travel trick from the 1978 Superman film in order to give himself another day before his homework is due. In a multi-part strip, Calvin is once again struggling with his homework and once again becomes Stupendous Man to solve a problem. This time he goes further and turns his school into a smoking crater in the ground. No school, no homework. Calvin's mother takes away his costume. What commonalities do we see in these early Stupendous Man strips? Calvin becomes Stupendous Man when he is under duress, when he is afraid of the world around him. Becoming a superhero, an invincible titan, allows himself protection from the world. Notice that Stupendous Man never actually saves anyone in these stories. He only saves himself from what he perceives to be danger. His mother, his babysitter, etc. Let's juxtapose these with other strips. In an earlier strip from 1985, Calvin is shown to be uncomfortable at the dinner table. His father won't even tell him what he's eating. Now we can laugh and say that maybe Calvin is a fussy eater, but Watterson obviously sympathizes with Calvin. Why must Calvin sit there and eat food that he clearly despises? Why can't his parents just level with him? As a child, I was not outwardly critical of the food I was given because I was afraid. In the house where I grew up, we did not have a lot of money, and saying that I wouldn't eat something because I didn't like it would make me feel guilty. I was raised very Catholic, and guilt is simply part of the deal. Church on Sunday, Catholic school, nuns, sacraments, confessing sins, waking up early because I was an altar server. I did not like going there. I didn't realize at the time that the constant guilt and talk of sin would have a profoundly negative impact on me. When I watch the news or scroll through my timeline and see war and poverty, something in my head tells me that it's my fault. I remember dropping a grocery bag once and spilling something. It couldn't have cost more than a few dollars, and I don't recall even being punished for it, but I felt terrible and I still think about it to this day. It's just in there. Calvin has the opposite problem, but it is no less painful. In Calvin's case, he is vocal about his displeasure. Strip after strip shows Calvin is sensitive to certain smells, textures, and tastes, but his parents imply that he is spoiled and that choking down food that makes him genuinely nauseous will build character. How can Calvin possibly enjoy his dinner if his father openly admits that it's not unlike a form of punishment, that it will harden Calvin and make Calvin more like his father? Watterson clearly sympathizes with Calvin. It's not enough to tell a child to do something that they despise and hope that the child will resent the parent for it on some level. Parents have to be better than that. Calvin is a handful, to say the least, but his parents don't always have the best advice or make the best choices. No parents do. For the record, forcing a child to eat food that they find disgusting and punishing a child by force feeding them is abuse. This is not a controversial opinion in child psychology circles. The long-term harm this does to children includes eating disorders and other traumas. Many children are sensitive to particular smells and tastes, and forcing them to relive this discomfort 3 meals a day is especially hazardous. In this strip from 1985, Calvin is accused of simply not paying attention in class. We see inside Calvin's imagination that he was thinking about being Spaceman Spiff, an intergalactic adventurer. In this strip from February 1986, Calvin is accused of the same thing and his persona is once again Spaceman Spiff. In this strip from later that year, Calvin is once again accused of not paying attention and once again is Spiff. Same thing in this one, noticing a pattern here. I entered the term paying attention into a Calvin and Hobbes search engine and found that a disproportionate amount were about Spaceman Spiff. Watterson uses different Calvin personas depending on which challenge Calvin is facing. When Calvin is afraid, he becomes Stupendous Man. When Calvin is bored, he becomes Spaceman Spiff. I didn't notice this as a child. I guess I wasn't paying attention. Calvin is an inventive, imaginative child, and those talents could be molded into a promising career, but he's not receiving the right kind of attention to assist with this goal. A common point of discussion among modern-day Calvin and Hobbes fans is that Calvin is probably dealing with undiagnosed ADHD. This infamous, fan-made comic strip draws a lot of criticism and praise depending on one's perspective. Despite the signature, it was absolutely not made by Bill Watterson. He would never do this. In one perspective, Calvin just needs the proper medication to get him through his schoolwork. Calvin is often portrayed as clever and full of ideas, even philosophical. If he could merely harness that, he could really be someone special when he becomes an adult. Without the proper care, Calvin might be doomed to a more mediocre life. Yet, in the final panel of this fan-made comic strip, isn't that what's happening? Isn't Calvin becoming mediocre but in a different way? That is the other perspective. Is this comic strip cynical or supportive? Hopeful or flavorful? Whether this is a sad ending or a happy ending is a Rorschach test for how we remember our childhoods and for how we see neuroatypical conditions. Regardless of how one views this as either a triumph or as the beginning of a more melancholy existence for Calvin, children should be tested for a wide range of neuroatypical conditions. What the family does with that information and what the child does with that information upon adulthood will vary, but having something undiagnosed and unknown altogether leaves the child without any option for dealing with it later in life. The premise of Calvin and Hobbes is that Calvin sees the world one way and everyone else sees the world another way. Whether or not Hobbes is real was a contentious question among young fans at the time. Watterson purposefully refused to answer that, not in the narrative and not in his rare interviews. Hobbes felt real, and that made sense to us. When we were children, everything felt magical and monstrous because we didn't have a lifetime of experience to temper our expectations or desensitize us to trauma. Everything was new. Everything was a surprise. Everything was shocking. We weren't able to protect ourselves. Calvin's imagination rang especially true for some of us. I did not have an imaginary friend as a child. I had imaginary world. Sewer, but it felt like it could have led anywhere. This is not a picture of it, but it looks something like this. I don't remember some specifics about my childhood. I seem to be especially incapable of remembering when things happened. When people ask me, I say, I don't know. When I was 8, 12, what do you want from me? I was called imaginative and artistic, but was actually suffering from a number of undiagnosed conditions. Most of them are still technically undiagnosed. I think I have come to prefer it that way. I'm tired of always being a new word. On October 10th, I walked into the Barnes & Noble and asked, where can I find the mystery? An employee led me to a section full of mystery novels. She misunderstood my question, and even though I thought I was being clear at first, I felt terribly embarrassed that I hadn't communicated myself correctly. It was my fault. My fault. I tried to explain, and another employee overheard and showed me where I could find Watterson's new book in the store. He looked about my age, and I suspect he might have read Calvin and Hobbes when he was a kid, too. When he found a copy of The Mysteries, he said, it's beautiful. You'll love it. I became emotional in public, and the employee was nice enough to pretend that he did not notice. So, Bill Watterson wrote a new book, and it's great. It truly is beautiful, and it now has a special place on my bookshelf. I have a degree in English, but I'm not a professional literature critic. So, here's what I think about it. It's the story of a kingdom that feared undefined mystery lurking in the shadows. When the knights captured the mystery, they learned its power, and the mystery became less frightening. Over time, more and more mysteries were revealed, creating more and more advances in technology. When the world, and spoilers here, is destroyed, the mysteries continue, because the universe exists independent of human consciousness, independent of our imagination. Things simply are. The mysteries of the universe will go on without us because we do not invent the universe. We only witness the universe. We are irresponsible with what we learn, but we're also, paradoxically, responsible for nothing. We are not important enough to be so responsible. Watterson sees the world eating itself. I see it too. But when we are gone, the universe will continue uninterrupted. That might sound defeatist, especially in the face of annihilation. But it's also quite comforting to know that we don't have to put that much pressure on ourselves. In the grand scheme of a universe that has existed for billions of years, we are all children. We should keep trying, of course, but we don't have to feel guilty all the time. It wasn't our fault.
The Crusaders set up fiefdoms and kingdoms all over the Eastern Mediterranean. Most of these European Crusaders left after a time, but impressive evidence of their invasions remains. The landscape is still dominated by Crusader redoubts, and they are fought over once again in what seems to be an endless sequence of violence. In 1190, the Frankish castle of Beaufort fell to Saladin. Between 1978 and 1982, it was a frontline position for Palestinian guerrillas in Lebanon. From the heights of Beaufort, they could look toward their Palestine. In 1190, the Frankish castle of Beaufort fell to Saladin. Between 1978 and 1982, was a frontline position for Palestinian guerrillas in Lebanon.
He's saying that for 20 years, until he was assassinated in 2008, and we'll get to the assassination in a minute, he managed to avoid the NSA, the CIA, all of our military intelligence people, SEAL Team 6,
and Mossad.
And
Mossad dearly wanted to kill him. And they know what they're doing. They were after him. They killed his brother. He completely disappeared. He used to ride a motor scooter, pretend to be a tailor, a butcher, something like that. Completely, he was unknown even in Hezbollah, which nominally he was under that umbrella. He was unknown. People didn't know who he was. Maybe three or four people did.
No defectors, nobody that could be turned?
Never had a defector from looking the other side. We had one from other hostage takers, we had from Iranians, but never in his group was anybody came out, you know, that betrayed him. So.
And what do you account, how do you account for this? You were, in your book, you say you were worried at one point that you were going to get hit by him.
Oh, I think definitely. They were looking at us. I mean, the problem is I grew up middle class, and I didn't grow up in a war zone. I mean, you take people who have been in a civil war, and their families are getting killed, and they're killing people. They tend to figure out what they're doing, and it's the Darwin effect. I mean, when I talk about, you know, the admiration is for his skill, but I certainly wouldn't trade my life for his. Growing up in the southern suburbs of Beirut, and you know, as a teenager, leaving school with a Kalashnikov and going shooting at the other side. This part of the world that's falling off, you know, progress and anything we take as civilization is growing by the day. I mean, you look at Mali, you look at Nigeria with Boko Haram, you look at ISIS, which is truly pre-Islamic. I mean, just cutting off heads with knives is tribal, or kidnapping women. This is tribal. It's nothing to do with Islam. So this world of Mughniyah's ability to murder people for political ends, there are more and more people that are capable of doing this. It was my interest in because this is part memoir. I mean, I write my mother into the story. She's a great character.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what is your mother doing in the middle of Lebanon?
Well, she was a great character in that one, so. And she, I mean, she should have had my job, but that's beside the point. But so, I mean, I want to make it personal how far I am from this world and even how far the CIA is. Yes, we can put drones up and we can sit in front of a flat panel screen and kill people, but this is not our world.
Well, you write that the best assassins or the best kills are local.
The best kills are in touch with them. And you know who the cancer is. You know who the problem is. And removing them. It is local. I mean, take one of the great assassinations, historically determined assassinations. That was Rabin, 1995. I think if anybody could have, you know, cut to the chase on a Middle East settlement, it was him. And he was a hero. He was well-respected. But if you take the point of his enemy, removing him truly made a difference. But that was very local kind of politics. I don't understand. But for them, it made sense. And of course, then I have to go back to the idea of killing. And clearly, that would have saved lives and avoided destruction untold, especially if it had been done in 33. There are occasionally figures in history which are cancerous, and they should be cut out. I mean, we hate assassination, which is Americans who just quite hate the idea. We hate to admit we do it.
Well, we do it. We've done it to Lincoln. We've done it to McKinley. We've done it to Morgan.
But
the most dangerous job in the world, actuarially, is president of the United States.
Yeah, exactly. But that's why we hate it so much. We think of Kennedy. We think of Lincoln. And it's lunatics and the rest of it. But what we're missing is the ability to change history at the particular moment in a particular context. It does save lives. And I think the reason I wrote this book is to examine this modern assassination. I talked about Lawson here very briefly. An academic at the University of Minnesota went out there and found out that at a certain point in Laotian history there were political assassinations. That the local communities, and the Laos are not violent people. They felt for their community survival they had to kill certain people. They did. And he found that it was a successful, most successful possible route to conflict resolution. And that's something we don't want to admit.
No, it reminds me, we had a local assassin here in the San Francisco area, a man named James Usual Fraviano, who was a mafia guy. And eventually he became a semi-celebrity, wrote a book, and flipped over and became a government witness. And I had the experience of having been sued by him, but then later interviewed him. Lee did you kill me, huh?
Lee did you
kill me? No, he told me that we only kill each other.
Okay.
Right? And you know, we never killed anybody who didn't deserve it.
Well, you know, no, that's the point, but in the heart of assassination, it has to be an act of justice, and even the victim side has got to look at it and think, yeah, and we know why you did it. The guy's really bad. You know, once I got deeper into this, I started talking to crazier and crazier people. Some of them were biologists. And they said, well, you know, in cell biology, there's a thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's maybe apoptosis, where the cells will kill another cell. It's cancer.
And so, McNea, or Hajar Radwan, escaped. Is the reason you wrote this book to detail all of your nightmares about him and try to figure it out?
Well, it's engagement. I mean, me and my team are the first Americans that have ever brought up and been in charge of assassination of a world leader by the Department of Justice and the FBI. So for me, which I'm actually in the middle of something, I start to understand it. I can get engaged. I can think about it.
Can you say this again?
Well, I was in Iraq in 1995.
With Ahmed
Chalabi. He wasn't part of it. The general came to me, sat down, wrote it up, sent it back on a tax set, which is classified, and didn't get an answer. Eventually, they came to me and said, well, Saddam is going to go to his palace at Al-Shah, and we've got we've suborned 12 tanks, and we've got the tank cells for them. What we're going to do is, once we get the palace, we're going to ask them to step down, or we're going to kill them. Tanks. I said, well, you know, is a tank's main gun an assassination weapon? I obviously know that, so I sent a message back to Washington saying, what's their plan? Are we okay? Are we on good ground? You know? I never got an answer. This action went forward. It was unstoppable at that point. And some of the militias I was working with overran three Iraqi divisions. And it was just quite messy, the whole engagement. And then I got a message from Washington saying, if you have a criminal lawyer, don't talk to him. Come right home. Trust us on this. There's been a problem. We can come back badged by the FBI. Have you ever had the office yellow tape by the FBI? And it's we're hauling you into the attempted murder synopsis. Eventually got through this investigation. But, I mean, even though we never actually pulled the trigger on Saddam, it gave me an insight into the way of thinking, the lawyers, what it's like in the field, how hard it is to target somebody like Saddam, just as it would be al-Baghdad today. Somebody on the move, no communications, you don't have eyes on the rest of it. So this is an examination of assassination. And it's sort of a funny title, but the perfect kill is nearly impossible. Black Swan.
But what you do talk about is the use of indiscriminate violence, whether it's drones or cruise missiles or by the U.S., as a tactic that's only going to backfire, that isn't going to succeed.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Lowell, we're doing what's called signature strikes. Unless you have a drone flying above and they see a couple guys with Kalashnikovs, you know, doing exercises in the field, and somebody back in Washington says, well, you know, they're near this village. This doesn't look right to us. We haven't had a drone strike in a month. Let's drop one, you know, from Mount Yemen or Pakistan. And you look at some years, we will have, you know, 750 drone strikes, and not a single name will ever appear of who we know it is. I mean, it's amazing. Or in cars, or... And we've overused it. The whole point of political murder is to make it very precise. I mean, you really scare the enemy when you get to the one guy who's causing you a problem rather than, you know, somebody who appears to be legal.
You notice the difference. In November of 2002, I was doing a story about the Lackawanna Six. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah.
The so-called terror sleeper cell in Lackawanna, New York. And they were recruited by a guy named Kamal Derwish, had lived in Saudi Arabia for a long time, but was an American citizen. And in November of 2002, a drone fired a missile at a vehicle in Yemen and blew the car up, and he was in the car. He was the first American citizen killed in there. And at that time, the U.S. government backed off. Oh, he was collateral damage. He didn't mean to do it. He was in the wrong car at the wrong time. Today, we take credit for it.
Well, I don't think there's any outrage. I mean, it's so complicated. Pakistan and Yemen and now Syria and Iraq, that people are just jaded. You know, they just don't care. You know, they don't care about the legal authorities. They don't care about the accuracy of drones. It's just like they don't care about enhanced interrogation. I mean, you know, frankly, I've been keeping track of this, and this is an aside, but the Senate has got 6,000 documents that say it doesn't work, and you got a few people involved in court who say it does, and my feeling is I want to see those 6,000 documents, and I want to make up my mind as an American whether torture makes us safer. I mean, that doesn't justify it morally, but I'd like to know, but we still don't know. I mean, there's two sides to this. I can't imagine that the Senate would just, you know, come to these conclusions that torture doesn't work, you know, because they want to, you know. I mean, I think they're basing it on evidence. So, and the war on terror is, I mean, it's gone everywhere. I mean, it's Somalia, in Africa, and who knows where it's going to go next? Anywhere where there's blank spots on the map would be scary war. But do we really stop to see what it's getting us? I don't know.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Warren Peace Report, and Amy Goodman with Amy Schiff. Deadly enough raids based on faulty U.S. intelligence, then covered up by a classified war loophole. This is a focus of a major new investigation by reporter Lindsay Billings, the CIA-backed Afghan special forces called Zero Group, which left a trail of civilian deaths across Afghanistan, but has yet to be held accountable after the U.S. ended its two-decade-long occupation. Lindsay Billings initially returned to Afghanistan to find out more about the death of her own mother and sister nearly 30 years earlier, but started to focus on the Zero Unit night raid when she first heard eyewitness testimony. Over the next 4 years, she visited the sites of more than 30 raids in Afghanistan and interviewed hundreds of people, including survivors and families of victims. She also spoke to soldiers inside the Zero Unit, who were the men tasked with killing their own compatriots on U.S. orders. In this clip from a forthcoming ProPublica documentary, two of them, Safia and Patty, described their work in 2019 in Afghanistan's Logar province near the forward operations base Shem. To protect their safety, their words are spoken by actors.
I'm a member of Afghanistan's Zero Unit in the east of the country. As intelligence comes in, the raid is conducted. It is our commander who gives us information.
We just have the shooting order.
Those are two soldiers with the so-called Zero Units in Afghanistan describing their work to reporter Lindsay Billing in her new expose for ProPublica, The Night Raid. She's joining us now from Istanbul, Turkey. She's an investigative journalist who's been reporting on Afghanistan since 2019. Born in Afghanistan, she is a British journalist. We welcome you, Lindsay, to Democracy Now! Can you talk about, lay out the findings of your piece, just who these Zero Units are, and in fact, you going there not exactly to investigate this story, but actually your own family and what happened to them?
Yeah, thank you for having me. This story really started in early 2019 when I went back to Afghanistan to look into my past and what had happened to my family. And it was in Nangarhar province in the east of the country where I'd met a distant relative and I was investigating the death of my mother in a raid there that had happened decades earlier, where I met a woman called Mazala. And she was a widow and she was in her 50s. And she was by herself because she was telling me the story of a night raid that had killed her two only children. And after meeting her and seeing this, she was just at a complete loss of what to do. And she really kind of turned to me as a foreigner to help her try understand what had happened to her son. And so after hearing his story, I just felt this huge responsibility to look into who was conducting these operations in remote and rural areas of Afghanistan. And that's when I kind of stumbled across the Zero Units, which are squadrons of Afghan special forces who were trained and funded and equipped by the CIA and who were joined on their operations by American Special Operations Forces members also, and at times, depending on the operation, CIA advisors. And these were counterterrorism operations. The Zero Units were sent after perceived threats against the United States, so first Taliban and in later years ISKP also. And so I started just hearing more and more reports of people who'd lost loved ones in these operations, and started to realize that they, while sometimes they were successfully targeting militants, that they were also getting it wrong.
And Lindsay, what did you learn about why, when the units were established, how many units there were, how many Afghans and American Special Forces were members of these units, and then explain why you chose to focus on one of them, 02.
Yeah, so there's four known zero unit squadrons, and they're based regionally across the country. And as you say, I focused on the 02, which was in the east, in Nangarhar. Their base is in Jalalabad. But they were also going on operations in neighboring provinces also. And I started to focus on the 02 because the more and more reports that I kept hearing of civilian casualties and botched operations, it was just a huge number coming from the 02. And also because I was in Nangarhar initially, and I just felt like there was pockets in Nangarhar that were, at that time, when this all started in early 2019, they were not being reached by a lot of media reporters. They were really inaccessible areas, and there was this increase in fighting going on, and it was really a hot spot for these operations. When it started, they were going out nearly every night. So it was really tracking these operations in real time. And that's why I really felt like I needed to speak with soldiers who were inside the O2. And I wanted to understand from them why they were going on these operations on U.S. orders, and why they were targeting their own countrymen. How did they feel when they went wrong? And I mean, these were huge operations. These are, 80 men on a night raid, of which 10 to 12 Americans were often joining, they were telling me, and huge convoys. They had access to air power as well, U.S. air power. They were so active in Nangarhar, and everyone knew who the zero units were. They knew what they wore. They knew how they were very greatly feared, and yet they didn't know who was behind them, who was compiling the intelligence, who was building the targeting packages and sending them out to target what was turning out to be students, university students, teachers, and farmers. And so people were really left without answers to what was happening on these operations.
And Lindsay, explain, I mean, you actually managed to speak to these two we played a clip earlier, Basir and Hadi. How did you get them to speak to you, first of all, and what was especially striking to you about what they said in your conversations with them?
I think it was probably about 6 months after I started looking for soldiers inside COC to talk to that I first met Basir and Hadi. And at first they were hesitant to talk to me. They didn't quite understand why I wanted to talk to them. And I guess over time they began to trust me, and that I did want to hear their perspective on what they were doing, and also their background, which played a big role into why they joined these operations and these units initially. And they really kind of started opening up over time, and there was a lot of pain and guilt with what they were doing, and also a lot of confusion as to their role within this setup and the structure of the zero units, who were nominally under the Afghan intelligence agency, but were under the umbrella of the CIA program as well. And they really, I think initially, there was one, I remember one specific meeting where they told me about one operation that had killed civilians, and that had not resulted in the death in finding the Taliban that they were looking for on that operation, and this kind of frustration from their part where they weren't the ones who could talk about it, and they were not writing up the after-action reports. It was the senior commanding officer who was doing it, and they weren't sure if anyone was even going to find out about the civilians killed in these operations. It was something out of their hands.
Lindsay, you spoke to a man named Singar who says he was shot 3 times when he was 12 years old by two soldiers outside their base in Jalalabad.
Yeah, and Singar was, I met Singar just this last year. Actually, by coincidence, and this was the U.S. had now left Afghanistan, and so much had changed over the course of this investigation, and very quickly for everyone. But he really stuck with me, because when I met him, he had been shot, as you say, 3 times outside his home, which was right next to the base in Jalalabad, the Urdu base. And he had been encouraged to file papers for compensation or compensation claim. And he, for his injuries, had been treated at the base in Jalalabad and also Bagram base. And he had filed these papers. And he had received a letter back. It was written in English, and he didn't speak English. He didn't read English. And it had declined to give him compensation for his injuries, and he had been waiting so long to hear if he was going to get this compensation for what had happened on that occasion. And he really stuck with me, because this was long after the U.S. had left, and there were still people in Afghanistan who are waiting to hear back on promises of compensation and things they've been encouraged to pursue. And this operation targeted him when he was 12, although on the form it was written that he was 14. For me, as to what really was left behind.
So I wanted to ask you about who is behind these zero units. And particularly, why, for example, that these raids are conducted by the CIA and not the military? What kind of loophole and lack of reporting, investigation, or accountability that leads to?
Well, there's a very murky area that these units fall into. Like as you say, they're not U.S. military counterterrorism operations. Because they fall under the CIA, they don't fall under the usual U.S. law that would apply to the military or Title X. And the U.S. Special Operations Forces, soldiers joining these operations, also don't fall under the same U.S. laws. Because these are now covert action operations. This is Title 50. So there is this complete legal loophole into them not receiving the same oversight and scrutiny that U.S. military operations would.
And when we talk about, you also spoke to a U.S. Army Ranger who conceded that these night raids had terrible effects. So he said that they were preferable to airstrikes, saying to you, you go on right night raids, make more enemies, then you got to go on more night raids for the more enemies you now have to kill. So you spoke to him. You also looked in the piece at the historical antecedents, the use by the U.S. of night raids. What did you understand about why Americans, the U.S. military and CIA use this particular method and have for decades?
Yeah, I mean, they've been using it for decades, using the night raid strategy since 1967 when they were doing his operations or capture-kill operations against the Viet Cong in South Vietnam and through Iraq, in which they were claimed as having major successes in targeting insurgencies and militants. And yet that's not the result that we see through our reporting, and that's not the result that came out afterwards, but it was a repeatedly used strategy that has failed time and time again, and that has not had a full accounting of it or what the fallout from these operations is.
And finally, what you feel, speaking to so many people, their attitude toward the United States with the number of deaths that have not been held accountable, and our families applying, do they know ways to reach out?
Yeah, I mean, this is really the legacy that America has left behind in Afghanistan. Many people I spoke to feel that these operations were counterproductive and actually had turned their families against the US-backed government in Kabul and against the US. And they will, if the same strategy is used in new conflicts and new wars, without someone looking at the tactics and saying, what is the failures of this year? We're having failures of intelligence. Then they will have the same fallout in other countries, and you will see a blowback the same as you have in Afghanistan, which is the way that people view the U.S. precisely because of witnessing years of these operations.
And Lindsay, finally, you conclude your piece by saying, in the end, I got closure for my own personal story from the unlikeliest source, Basir. Explain what you found out, what happened to your mother and to your sister, and why you say that Basir provided you with this closure.
Looking for with what had happened to my family, but I do feel, and I think that is really in part something that we see in Afghanistan in general, which is that one family's of loss and tragedy is replaced by another as one war bleeds into the next and it gets covered up. And so what happened to my family was so long ago now, and then what happened is the families of me in 2019 up and, you know, over the last few years was a recent conflict. But I think that with Basir, the reason I felt some level of closure with it was because although he hadn't targeted my family and he hadn't killed them, there was an understanding from him that kind of surfaced over time and through our regular meetings and conversations over time. This understanding that he had of what the real true human cost of these operations was and how everyone was affected, from the families and survivors. So there was something about him reaching that understanding that helped me feel.
Standing next to Jill in this shot is her good friend Barry Horn, an animal liberation fighter who died in prison in 2001 whilst on hunger strike in relation to the broken promises that New Labour has made regarding animal abuse, specifically the protection.
To start off by saying that there's a new Oxfam report that came out just in some kind of the Davos meetings. Just the headline of it is that the richest 1% bagged nearly twice as much wealth as the rest of the world put together over the past 2 years. So inequality keeps rising, it does not stop, and the increase in inequality is the result of what I've in my book, The Success of Austerity. And in fact, we are in a moment, especially in the UK today, that austerity is back with a vengeance. It's not normally used as a term, but it underlines the main trope of contemporary policy. So the hike in interest rates we have seen now for more than 6 months all around the globe, together with cuts, especially in the social sector. So the fact that while we're spending more money, of course, in the military sector, there's a constant transfer of resources away from schools, from hospitals, and from all sorts of public benefits. And this goes hand in hand with the third element of austerity. So we talked about monetary, fiscal, industrial, which is fundamentally constant privatization, deregulation of the labor market, and direct attacks on organized labor. In order to make sense of the fact that austerity is back with a vengeance, it is important to avoid just dismissing it as pure irrationality and figuring out why is it so persistent, and why does it shape our lives in claim of the book is that it has saved our lives for more than 100 years, and somehow that austerity is actually structural to capitalism. It is actually the DNA of our social economic system, somehow. So the idea here is to repoliticize what austerity is and say, well, of course, as Mariana was pointing out, austerity has not worked in its purported goals of balancing the budget, cutting debt, and boosting economic growth, right? So the objective that it claims to be trying to achieve, that's clearly not worked, right? It's clearly been wrong in this respect. However, in a way, if you look at it from a lens of class analysis, which is something that few economists do, then we realize that austerity is success in something much deeper. And it's actually the reason for the title, the capital order. The idea is that capital as well, capital as GDP growth, requires capital as the fundamental social relation that governs our society, by which we all accept our condition as low-paid wage workers. So in this sense, austerity is persistent because it protects the capital order. It serves as a buffer in moments in which the capital order is challenged. Austerity helps preserve our condition of market dependence and precariousness, thus the possibility of keeping wages low, and expectations for profit high. So this is kind of the thesis of the book, is that austerity functions politically to safeguard the foundations of our capitalist social economic system, which is the fact that wage relations and private property as the means of production cannot be contested. And this logic of austerity, which in a way is appearing very clearly, I think, in the U.S. research today, the temporality here is quite obvious. There's been the great resignation, there's been actually huge amounts of social upheaval, triggered, of course, by mounting inflation, and the reaction, the book came out on the day Chancellor of the Exchequer Hunt announced $300 billion a huge amount of cuts in the social sector, of course, while the Bank of England was increasing. So the idea here is that we need to connect monetary and fiscal policy with industrial policy, labor relations. And if we instead look at monetary and fiscal policy as something separate from our daily lives and the shaping of our human behavior, I think that doesn't really get to why austerity then is constantly used, even if, you know, Mariana's work, the work of many other very important scholars, show that it is wrong in the sense that it does not work to increase for its status. So this idea emerges quite clearly if we look at the moment in which austerity emerged for the first time in such clear-cut terms, which is the moment in which capitalism underwent the biggest existential crisis of all. And I'm referring to the years immediately after the First World War. The book begins telling the story of how the Great War, 1914-1918, was a moment of enormous shock for the laissez-faire economic order until that moment, in which state interventionism, more collectivism, the fact that the state actually became the main employer and the main producer, fundamentally shook the idea that private property of the means of production and wage relations were somehow natural givens that were, in a way, facts that no one could challenge. So this fundamental repoliticization of the economic sphere brought about a variety of practical alternatives, from more reformist to more radical, and this is what I do in the first part of the book, is that I reconstruct the full spectrum of experiments, both theoretical and practical, which calls fundamentally for forms of economic democracy. of various types. There were the Reconstructionists that were kind of proto-Keynesians prior to Keynes, and actually more radical than Keynes in the UK. The book is a comparison between what happened in Italy and what happened in Great Britain. And the reason for this, I will tell you in a bit. But what is clear is that in both countries, the war triggered a reconsideration of the very foundations of our economic system. The book is done all through primary archival sources. So there is data, which you can find in chapter 9. Structured through qualitative reconstruction of the spirit of the time, through documents emerging from the Bank of England archives, the Treasury archives, and the newspaper of the time. And, of course, I didn't put the page correctly, but I just wanted, if I find it in a minute, otherwise I give up, the type of wording that were kind of everywhere going on. So this is Lloyd George, who was the head of the government in November 1918. He was saying, we cannot return to the old conditions. War is like a plowshare and a harrow. It has turned up and rent the soil of Europe. You cannot go back. And it's full of all sorts of announcements of this necessity for radical change, the fact that there was no way that capitalism was going to survive for more than a couple of years. And this was a sentiment that was shared by the bourgeoisie and by the Times and the Economist, but also, of course, by the radical workers organizing and mobilizing. So I give life to the spirit of the time and look at the Guild Socialist movement, the cooperative movement, the Sankey Committee for the Nationalization of Coal and Self-Management of Industry, the Workers' Councils, all the way to the case of L'Ordine Nuovo and Gramsci's militant action in Turin in 1919-1920 that provoked the occupation of the factories that took place throughout the whole peninsula in the summer of 1920. So in all of this moment of fundamental claims for economic democracy, of regaining back a say in economic decision-making, of course, a reaction, a very powerful reaction, emerged. And that's what part two of the book is all about. It's about the role, especially I focus on the role of economic experts in their position as representatives of the new paradigm of economics which was emerging, the so-called pure economics, that is the outcome of the marginalist turn and the foundation of the neoclassical economic framework, what is still unfortunately dominant today. And what I show is how, for the first time, economists were called at the Brussels and Genoa conference of 1920-1922 to advise governments and with the governments of the whole Europe, a new financial code based on austerity was put together. And this is what is reconstructed in chapter 5 of the book. And it's amazing how the type of rhetoric used, we have lived above our means, it's all the fault of the fact that workers are just too lazy, there's not enough production, people are consuming too many biscuits. This type of rhetoric, Luigi Einaudi, are considered a great anti-fascist, was very much favorable to fascism in the 20s because of its capacity to impose austerity. And his classism over biscuits, sorry, just because I said it, it's like really what himself, I know. And I've been presenting this book for a while, but I'm so out of it that I can't ever make it. Okay, this is Einaudi in 1920 writing on Corriere della Sera. It is well known that the wages of workers in the industrial and commercial areas of Italy have increased noticeably. The evidence being the conspicuous increase in unnecessary consumption of alcoholic drinks, of sweets, chocolates, and biscuits. And this is just one of the many quotes in which it is clear. Of course, this is Pantaleoni, one of the founding fathers of pure economics with Jevons and Dalras. He was even more classist. He says, the notable increase of wages was not accompanied by greater civilization, so that the worker and his spouse lived like pigs in their homes in order to waste the greatest part of their income in wine at the tavern. So these are eminent economists that are still studied today as, you know, the founders of our economic theory. What the effort of the book is to combine what they were writing in their abstract treatises with what they were writing in the press and in their public declaration. And what appears clearly is that the emergence of the expert as this unbiased, above-class truth, owner of the truth, came hand-in-hand with a very classist ambition of disciplining the population by using economics as this apolitical weapon that could tell people, you have nothing to contribute here because you're ignorant, you're stupid, leave the economic sphere to the experts. We will tell you what is good for everyone. And of course, the good for everyone, if you look at the data of the time, results in wage suppression, increases in profit shares, while the wage share goes down, and surge in the profit rate. So this financial code of austerity, which comes in the form of again, fiscal, monetary, industrial austerity, fiscal being cuts in social expenditures and regressive taxation. At the time, all the ideas of taxing the riches, what we're used to now, the allergy to taxing the riches, was really a turn of events with respect to what was happening immediately after the war, in which the capital levy, the idea of actually really expropriating all the extra profits, was kind of considered normal. And this, in a matter of a couple of years, is completely reversed in favor of taxing through consumption taxes. So indirect taxation as, of course, the quintessence of regressive taxation. Hand in hand with monetary austerity, increasing interest rates, which in Britain caused a recession. So this is the whole point, is that it was known that the increase in interest rates would cause a recession. But this was kind of somehow politically intelligent, because it caused an increase in unemployment rate, which of course meant that, and this I have all the graphs, show that this meant a complete appeasing of industrial arrest. All the strikes stopped because of this increase in unemployment rate, and this is Michael Kalecki telling us clearly that the disciplinary mechanisms of increasing unemployment and what guarantees the end of the questioning of wage relations and the acceptance of lower wages. So while in Britain what happened was that the government in power followed the advice of the experts who are the protagonists of my book, Ralph Hawtrey, the in-house economist at the British Treasury, who had an enormous influence on the Chicago School of Economics later on, with all the controllers of finance who were the bureaucrats. We'll be right back. who are directly advising the Chancellor of the Exchequer, so the people who were not elected, but were actually forming the economic models that then were so influential in the austerity policy. In Britain, it was about tweaking the dials of macroeconomic management to induce the recession, which ultimately appeased the population. A quote from G.D.H. Cole. G.D.H. Cole was a guild socialist, active, militant intellectual at the time. He saw what was going on very, very sharply. The big working class offensive had been successfully stalled off, and British capitalism, though threatened with economic adversity, felt itself once more safely in the saddle. So he makes it very clear that if we look at austerity from the point of view of class relations, austerity may not be good in stabilizing the economy, but it's very good at stabilizing class. The short-term cost of economic downturn for longer-term gain of securing the capital order, which is kind of what is most important if we want to safeguard capitalism, even at the cost of an economic recession. So while this form of economic coercion was what wielded the return of consensus for the system in Britain, in parallel, the book looks at what was happening in Italy. And in Italy, what is for me important here about the comparison is that I wanted to look at two countries that both from an institutional and an ideological point of view cannot be understood as more, you know, different, right? The poles apart, cradle of parliamentary liberalism. Advanced economic empire, Great Britain, and on the other hand, the birthplace of fascism in Italy. And what you see if you take the lens of austerity is that the treatment both countries and the economic experts advising the state were really treating their citizens very, very similarly. So while in Britain it was again more about economic coercion, even if again laws were passed to suppress strikes, for example, emergency acts of the type we're seeing by the way today again, it seems in this country, Italy, the force of the state, of course, in imposing law and order was stronger, because we well know that the fascist dictatorship implied the torture, the jailing, and the killing of political opponents. Not only were the parallelism in these supposed opposite worlds so obvious in terms of economic policymaking and ideology backing the policymaking, there is also another striking fact, which is how supportive of Mussolini's regime the whole British liberal elite was in the 1920s, because Mussolini was the best students of austerity in those years. So I went into the archives of the Treasury and the Bank of England, and what you see is quotes such as the one of Montagu Norman. Montagu Norman was the head of the Bank of England. And in 1926, after the Legge Fascistissima has passed, Mussolini had shown the full-blown, violent face of fascism. This he writes to Jack Morgan of J.P. Morgan's Chase, again, very supportive financially also of Mussolini. Fascism has surely brought order out of chaos over the last few years. Something of the kind was no doubt needed if the pendulum was not to swing too far in quite the other direction. The Duce was the right man at a critical moment. And again, this is the thing that it seems like I exaggerate when I tell the story, but the book is all done through the words of the protagonists themselves, because I think it's the words they use and then also the events that happen that really give a sense of the violence of austerity and this anti-democratic thrust of austerity that is still clearly obvious to this book. So the typical case of Augusto Pinochet in Chile with the book The Chicago Boys in the 70s is not the first case of the whole international liberal establishment supporting authoritarian governments once it's about economic efficiency to suppress what is considered a restless population, such as the Italian one after the First World War. I think I can stop here, and then there's much else of
dysfunctional policies we have today, including this kind of automatic idea that you just raise interest rates and somehow that's going to reduce inflation, when the real issue is inequality in terms of wealth concentration, this idea of excess profits that should be taxed but aren't. Where the traditional economic theory that you promote in some ways responsible for this lack of attention today, like naming, not so much about naming and shaming individuals, but the bits of neo-classical economics, because that's a big word, neo-classical economics. There's grounds within neo-classical economics that one could look at as justifying these problematic policies today, which don't take into account issues around inequality, wealth concentration. You mentioned the Oxfam report, but literally this idea of excess profits and rent being at the core.
Yeah.
So one of the things Mussolini also did is very much against actually a lot of the stuff that you talked about. So setting up the Istituzione della Ricostruzione Italiana, the famous treaty, big state on enterprise, that's kind of in the opposite bucket that we would usually have put up there. In fact, with Truss's government, you know, they were blamed for having, you know, begun with these policies of, you know, reducing taxes. Isn't that a bit of a oxymoron, right? That you have on the one hand someone who, as you say, is kind of justifying and is embedding austerity at the deep level, Mussolini, but who's also very pro-statist in the sense of investment and public ownership and public enterprise. If you could just say something about that,
yes.
Then we'll move on to
yes,
the rest.
You.
Because it is,
yes,
you didn't
thank
mention
you.
That.
Thank you. So, the space in which Mussolini does put together IRI matters, because it's a moment in which the capital order in the country had already been regained through austerity. So I think this is very important, because actually polemic against what was called le bardature di guerra, overstepping of the state in taking over many of the economics of the private sector during the war, was something that was a campaign that was really at the forefront of all liberal economists and fascist economists alike in the early 20s. So really the reuniting under we need to privatize, and actually Mussolini under the biggest large-scale privatization campaign in modern capitalism happened in Italy in the 20s. Everything is privatized until 25, 26. And this is very important because, of course, it increases the market dependence of workers. The first thing Mussolini does is actually fire 63,000 public employees with the idea that in this way, you can, right? So there's this first phase of privatization that I think is very, very important in securing the end of industrial unrest, because it disempowers the workers. And following that, then I think there is a space for the state to intervene economically without this causing political unrest. While already in 1919-1920, also when the British government was actually wanting to maintain state intervention, actually wanted to increase nationalization, like in the case of... What you saw there is that these reformist objectives were actually achieving results that were not reformist at all because the demand for more radical social change. So I think it's only when we... And when it's clear, for example, to give an example, the fact that usually you associate fascism with corporatism, and you understand corporatism as something very different from the market economy that is, you know, typical of our current state of affairs, or in a way, you know, just to simplify. But the point is that corporatism is seen as a beast of its own. And this is a problem because then fascism is, you say, well, there's the liberal phase of fascism, which is the austerity phase, but that's not really fascism. Fascism comes later in the form of corporatism. But actually, if you see, the only element of continuity in fascist economic policy is wage repression. And prioritizing private investors, what Meloni, the right government calls the real producers. Real producers. The producer is not the worker anymore. That was, that's again something that's killing the economic model, right? It's the saver investor who becomes central, and the real producer is the private investor. So in corporatism was never challenging private investors as central to the economic machine. Then the idea was that the state could help and take a role, but you would never challenge wage relations and private property as a means of production, and wage repression remains a constant even when forms of greater interventionism are put into place. So the intention here is exactly to try to shake a little bit of what is the common sense understanding that the problem is neoliberalism, and that neoliberalism is the exception. Can revert to a more human phase of capitalism. I really think that if one looks at history through the lens of austerity, what you can see is not only that Keynes ultimately was very well, Keynes was someone who was very politically aware, and he realizes still in 1942, so after he writes the general theory and has, you know, repudiated Say's law and so like criticized the Treasury view and all of this, he is someone who really says, if I had to go back, I would inflict the same doses of your money. He was advocating for 10% in 1920, so even higher than what the Bank of England was doing in 1920. Because I think ultimately Keynes is someone who, even if he likes to, you know, portray the economy as something that has to do only with technical matters, you had fascist cabinet expelling any political participation in economic decisions. In Great Britain, it was about protecting the Bank of England as an independent institution and actually exporting the central bank independence in other countries. In India, Basil Blackett, one of my protagonists, goes to India. Established as independent central bank. Also, Niemeyer, the other controller of finance, goes to Brazil. And to establish a central bank that is independent there, with the idea, of course, what we hear all the time, which is only central bank independent central banks can actually do less inflation, more inflation averse than any other actor, right? And this is exactly, but I think this is important also to answer the question. The ECB is the most independent central bank
both politically in the sense that it forbids any, explicitly forbids to receive any instruction from either community or national political institution. This is Article 7 of its constitution, but it's also economically independent in the sense that it has no obligation to finance the member nation's public deficit. This is Article 7 of its constitution, but it's also economically independent in the sense that it has no obligation to finance the member nation's public deficit. The member nation's public deficit. The ECB is the best embodiment of central bank independence. And central bank independence is, of course, the idea that... in the hands of the experts and away from the people, And, you know, there's other ways in which you can de-democratize the economy. For example, as in Italy right now, we have introduced the balanced budget clause in our constitution. So a different way, but certainly central bank independence is a very important way of securing austerity as the norm. Change was someone who really saw the importance of excluding the general public from economic decisions and keeping it in the hands of the experts. And this is something that he saw very clearly when he was confronted with the revolutionary potentials that were emerging after the First World War. So even once he changes his theoretical framework, he himself says, there is a class war, and I'm on the side of the educated bourgeoisie, and this is just his position, and this is, you know, quoting him directly.
Very, very much. There are many ways one can die. Many ways one can achieve death. Many ways one can achieve post-mortem.
So he never kind of hid where he stood in terms of the class struggle. And I think, in a way, this speaks to the fact that when it comes to safeguarding someone like Jeff Mann in his book on Keynes called The Fragile Crux of Bourgeois Civilization, then Keynes is pro-austerity, right? So, again, I think there's a space to be Keynesian. One, the general social order is secure. Then you can be Keynesian within certain limits, of course, social expenditures, then you've got a problem there. So either you find other ways. So of course you can.
It's a parallel in what you just said, though, right? With what you said about distributing.
Yes, I think so.
The social order can be progressive.
Exactly. So I think that's kind of the thing. So in this sense, I need to. The next project is to look at the golden age through this lens, and I think what you can see and what I've already started seeing is actually that
If you look at what happened in the United States after the Second World War, the change in experts, for example, in the Council of Economic Advisors in the United States, they were Keynesians, self-proclaimed Keynesians, and actually more radical than the new Keynesians that came after. But in a certain way, they used Keynesianism to, for example, keep very high surpluses in moments of economic growth. So paradoxically, there's a very good book. Keynesianism meant higher surpluses during the golden age. During the golden age. Fear of inflation that constantly hunts austerity. It's a fear that actually is quite shared as in those years by the Keynesians. What I'm saying is that I think there's reason to try to at least criticize or look maybe a little bit differently to this supposed idealized virus that we kind of study. You know, it was a golden age for the very small minority of countries in the West and the world. Italy, for example, never did. So again, I think there's nuances and we try, in that sense, of course, that's why it's not really a conventional. I think this is the idea of coming up with a book that tries to, you know, give some tools.
So that's sort of the point. In the meantime, a lot has happened.
I think I was quite lucky because it speaks more to us right now than maybe a couple of years ago when I wrote. So Lauren Summers on the Bloomberg Wall Street Week, March 5, 2021. The Federal Reserve needs to remember that their priority is the macroeconomy. When I see them say that they won't raise rates until diversity group unemployment rates are appropriate, I get nervous. If they take inflation seriously, monitor it closely, and are prepared to cause pain, they will be able to control inflation. Lauren Summers, when I see them say that they won't raise rates until diversity group unemployment rates are appropriate, I get nervous. If they take inflation seriously, monitor it closely, and are prepared to cause pain, they will be able to control inflation. To see them say that they won't raise rates until diversity group unemployment rates are appropriate, I get nervous. If they take inflation seriously, monitor it closely, and are prepared to cause pain, they will be able to control inflation. Lauren Summers. When I see them say that they won't raise rates until diversity group unemployment rates are appropriate, I get nervous. If they take inflation seriously, monitor it closely, and are prepared to cause pain, they will be able to control inflation. Lauren Summers. When I see them say that they won't raise rates until diversity group unemployment rates are appropriate, I get nervous. If they take inflation seriously, monitor it closely, and are prepared to cause pain, they will be able to control inflation. Lauren Summers. Lauren Summers. Lauren Summers. Lauren Summers. So I think this is kind of the go-to narrative that has even boosted further in these last years, the idea that inflation is a problem and there is no alternative. There is no alternative of the capital order. You could, you know, there's. So I think in this sense, that it proves the case of how the objective of curing inflation and balancing the budget is really somehow less important or often used as a as a pretext to a much deeper problem that Larry Summers is pointing out in this quote and still right now, which is, hey, the labor market is too tight. The labor market is too tight. People are not going back to work. There is a huge problem with the Great Resignation. There is a big anti-work movement in the United States emerging. There are strikes in sectors that until very recently had been completely deregulated, right? The unions, Amazon, Starbucks, whatever. This is a moment in which, this is why there's no option but inflation and no other kind of way to cure inflation, because we got to discipline the people to go back and allow us to avoid the cost of labor being too high, because otherwise our economy is not going anywhere and we are in trouble. So I think there's a sense by which the austerity economists are aware and are making quite explicit in the words they're using, even someone like Jerome Powell, I believe, of what is really at stake right now, which is this disorder. I think this is true also in Britain right now. If it's all about balancing the budget, then you could do it by A, taxes on the wealthy, 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 taxes on the wealthy.